1997, three friends and I trekked deep into the Alpine, about 8 hours from here on Vancouver Island. For days, we saw no one. Rock, trees, isolation. This is paradise. Our element, this backcountry camping stuff. The grueling uphill trudge with a 50-pound pack in blazing heat with the nearest water source 3 hours away. Love it. The insects? I mean, the opaque, fuzzy brown layer of mosquitoes carpeting my buddy's back. Ha! This is the life. The onerous hoisting of food bags 3 times a day to avoid attracting ravenous bears. Glorious. People pay thousands to do this. And of course, the company, the camaraderie, the teamwork. As leader of our expedition, I was all about the teamwork and the good camp practices. Even when our big, perpetually amiable, totally inexperienced friend Danny confessed, to be honest with you, I've never been camping or hiking. Well, that's no problem. I have enough experience to guide you. I enjoyed being the veteran expert in our little group. When it came time to plan our approach and scramble up Mount Septimus, I was judicious, cautious, maybe a little stern. We reached our first bit of hands and feet scrambling. I scouted about 20 feet up, a 30-degree slab of rock. Easy enough. Sandra and Leslie were nimble. But halfway up the sloping bit of rock, Danny looked down and froze. Then he started to tremble. I'm talking Wile E. Coyote, full body earthquake tremble, earthquake pills tremble. I realized at that moment I was not myself prepared to lead even this little scramble. I really didn't have the knowledge or experience to get us up and down a mountain. I hadn't really assessed our abilities in any kind of honest way. Really, I had kind of bluffed my way into leading us 10 feet up a tiny slab of rock at the bottom of a mountain in the middle of the wilderness where, in perfect weather, we were stuck. It took nearly an hour with me guiding Danny's down-climbing feet a few inches at a time by hand to finally cover 10 feet of mild slope so that we could stand up again and hike down. I kind of cried for a couple of minutes. Maybe it was relief. Anyway, with a little less bravado, we made our way back to camp. And I knew that I'd gone up that mountain not on honest merit, but on an elevator of pride that I rode much higher than honestly I was really meant to be. I'm lucky and grateful to gently come back to earth for now.
We Unitarian Universalists generally believe that to live with integrity, we need to be honest with self and others. We are against fake news, against politicians who lie. We believe in upholding covenants, telling the truth, and building trust. We believe this, and we want to be people of integrity. And yet, most of us are less honest than we could be. Apparently, it is a common human failing. Psychology professor Dr. Robert S. Feldman, who studies lying, found that when people meet each other for the first time, for every 10 minutes of conversation, they will lie an average of 2 to 3 times. Not big lies or mean-spirited lies, but little stretches of the truth that make themselves look good, or slight untruths or exaggerated compliments that make the other person feel good. According to one article, the types of lies in which we engage include exaggerating accomplishments, downplaying failures, giving fake compliments, agreeing outwardly when you don't agree inwardly, Canadians. Sorry. Saying yes when you'd rather say no, spreading rumors, telling someone it will be okay when it will not be okay, hiding your activities or sneaking, and going along with the crowd. Researchers on lying agree that over time, even small lies can have detrimental effects on relationships and society at large. Stress, anxiety, and insecurity rise. Trust erodes. Take a moment to consider, how honest are you? Here are some sample scenarios. You are in a conversation with a group of people you admire but don't know very well. A name is repeatedly referenced in the conversation. Sounds like it is a historical or political figure that they all know. You are not familiar with the name, but you don't want to appear ill-informed. What do you do? Do you ask who it is and risk being judged as ignorant? Do you remain silent, hoping they won't notice that you are not following the conversation? What if your knowledge is tested more directly? If someone started the conversation by saying, "Of course, you know so-and-so, right?" Do you nod vaguely with the others? Or do you keep your head still, neither affirming nor denying, and hope they don't notice? Do you fudge with something like, "The name is familiar, but I can't recall the particulars. Can you remind me?" A second scenario. You are backing up a car at the mall and bump into a parked car. Do you get out and check for damage? If you see that you have, in fact, dented the other car, do you leave a note? Does your answer change depending on the size of the dent? Or whether you are in a rush? Does your answer change depending on how expensive the car looks and how stressed you are about your own finances? Does your answer change if your 8-year-old child or niece or grandchild is in your car, witness to your actions? How about this one? Your friend is really excited to give you a gift for your birthday. When you open it under their expectant gaze, you see that it is a sweater that is far too busy for your taste. You know you will never wear it. What do you do? Do you avoid commenting on the appearance of the sweater itself and just say how much you appreciate their thoughtfulness? When they fish for comments on the sweater, do you say statements of fact as if you are pleased about it? It's so colorful! Or do you know that they will see through that tactic, so instead opt for falsehoods that will appease? It's beautiful. Thank you. Would there be any conditions under which you would admit that you don't actually care for the sweater? Last scenario, this is the hardest one. You are visiting your aunt who has dementia. She is unable to retain the fact that her beloved husband died years ago and repeatedly asks where he is. What do you say? Is this one of the rare situations in which a lie is actually best? Do you tell her that he is at work or traveling and will be home later? Or do you look for something that is true but not upsetting? He's not here right now, but I'll be here until 7. What would you like to do together? As many of you know, there are a million different variations of that dilemma, and there are seldom easy answers. From serious matters to trivial matters, different people are dishonest in different situations for different reasons. So here are another two questions for all of us to ponder. When do you lie, and why do you lie? Or if you think you never out and out lie, in what situations do you tend to avoid telling the whole truth, and why? One article I read pointed out that many of our lies are motivated by a desire for protection. In the realm of self-protection, we often lie to protect our image, to save face, to avoid judgments by others. Hence the temptation to fail to admit ignorance about that historical figure that everyone else knows. Or maybe that one doesn't speak to you. You are confident enough that you always readily admit when you don't know something. What are the judgments that motivate you to be less than honest? Maybe you blame your lateness to a meeting on traffic, despite the fact that you would have been late regardless of traffic, because you fear that people will judge you as irresponsible or inconsiderate. I have noticed that I am reluctant to admit how late I like to sleep in on mornings that I can. Morning people always seem to have the moral upper hand. Have you noticed that? I don't want them to judge me as lazy or self-indulgent. Perhaps you notice that you understate your own wealth in some situations and overstate it in others, for people can be judged both for having too much as well as for having too little. Perhaps your untruths are aimed at avoiding judgment about your physical capability, or your life choices, or your parenting choices. Maybe you avoid admitting some things that you still do that you know are not good for the environment, ways in which you still fall short of your own standards. I noticed, by the way, that paying attention to where we avoid the truth can help us to evaluate our own actions. I used to feel awkward about admitting, and I feel awkward right now, that I ate at McDonald's. I really love their burgers and fries, and it's so affordable. But my guilt was a signal to me that eating there goes against my own values. The conflict in this case was strong enough that as a part of my Eco Games pledge, I am experimenting with giving up McDonald's for a year. I really miss those fries, but I am sticking with it so far. A counterpoint example, I used to avoid admitting that I watched TV for fear of being judged by those who thought it was a waste of time at best, or at worst, intellectually vacuous and morally questionable. Now, I am secure in my choice. It may not be the best use of my time, but it helps me unwind, and I love getting involved in the stories about human struggle and striving. And so I am able to be honest now and admit freely that, yes, I watch TV. Back to the larger point. We are often tempted into dishonesty as a way to protect our self-image. We are also sometimes tempted into dishonesty as a way to protect our resources, money, possessions, or time. Hence the motivation to not leave a note on the car one bumps in the parking lot. The extent to which anyone is less than exactingly honest on their tax returns falls under this category as well. If you've ever been tempted to order the cheaper kids' meal for a kid who is 1 year older than the limit, you know this category of motivation. Sometimes we rationalize that some of the dishonesties in this category are not really that bad because the systems from which we are protecting our resources are unjust anyway. For example, when we apply for financial aid for university, there are some tricks aimed at getting a better deal. People have to figure out whether a given tactic is justified because they themselves are at such a disadvantage when up against the unreasonably high university costs, or whether that tactic, in fact, takes away from other students who need it even more. It's a tough call. Some untruths are aimed at protecting one's own image and one's own resources. Consider the exhausted co-parents who, in who does what negotiations with one another, might each overstate the amount of time they put into family chores, or might be tempted to hide any time or sleep they have managed to steal for themselves. They protect their own resources as well as their image as generous team-playing co-parents. Another example, if you are someone who is reluctant to speak up for your own needs, you can develop ways of getting what you want by cloaking it in an offer that appears to benefit the other. Instead of saying, "I want to go to restaurant X tonight," you may say, "Hey, as a treat for you, we could go to restaurant X that has that dish you really like." From protecting our image to protecting our resources, those were all examples of being dishonest to protect our own interests. Sometimes we are dishonest to protect others. Maybe you pretend you like that sweater gift from your friend more than you really do. Or maybe when a friend asks your opinion on a new haircut, you give a more positive review than you actually feel. Sometimes our dishonesty protects self-image and others' feelings. What do you do, for example, when you can't remember someone's name? You don't want them to feel like they don't matter to you, and you don't want them to think you are inconsiderate or arrogant or feeble-minded. To admit that you've forgotten may hurt their feelings and may make you look bad. Do you do it anyway, or do you fake it? Sometimes it is unclear just who is being protected by dishonesty. Consider this, I have to say, typically Canadian situation. Person A is annoyed at person B. But when asked about it, person A says, "No, it's fine." Then person A goes and complains to person C. Dishonesty rooted in avoiding conflict, which usually does not avoid conflict at all. It just keeps it festering underground. That's probably a whole sermon unto itself. There are some kinds of lying to protect the feelings of others that we don't do anymore. People used to lie to the ill and dying about the seriousness of their condition. Now we know that most of us prefer the truth when we are ill or dying. People used to lie to adopted children about their origins. Now we know that kids do much better when they know their birth stories from the very beginning. Still, the question persists, is honesty always the best policy? Some of the most scrupulous scholars do, in fact, allow for exceptions. One of the most important researchers on lying, Cicela Bock, allows that lying is indeed the most ethical choice in cases where there are no alternatives when it is done to protect an innocent life, as was the case for people who were hiding Jews from Nazis in World War II. But what about less extreme circumstances? What about our aunt with dementia who's forgotten that her husband has died? If a lie is what is necessary to prevent her suffering again and again, isn't that warranted? If you were the aunt, what would you want? When sorting through honesty scenarios, especially when considering cases in which dishonesty is aimed at protecting the feelings of others, you will note that we often come upon a tension between honesty and compassion. Those who lean toward compassion will often sacrifice honesty to do so. They will offer comforting, though false, assurances to the aunt with dementia. They assure their friend that they love the gift, that the haircut looks great. On the other end of the spectrum are those who lean toward honesty at the expense of compassion. When someone begins a sentence with, frankly, or to be honest, the listener knows to brace themselves. Something hurtful is likely coming. Some even use honesty as an excuse to say something hurtful without taking care to be kind, as in, I'm just being honest. My wife reminded me of this Taylor Swift lyric. You call me up again just to break me like a promise. So casually cruel in the name of being honest. Ouch. So here is a question for us all to consider. Is your personal growth to be found in practicing being more honest or practicing being more compassionate? When you regret a particular interaction, is it because you tend to be too honest or not honest enough? What would your friends say? Of course, most of us strive for both, if possible. We try to say the true thing with as much kindness as possible. So where are we? We asked, in what situations are you honest and why? We considered lies that protect the self, both self-image and resources, and lies that protect others. We allowed that honesty might not always be the best policy and noted a tension between honesty and compassion. Here's a theory I just came up with this week. I wonder if creating a more compassionate culture would in turn foster a culture of increased honesty. Here's my reasoning. If a lot of our dishonesty is rooted in an impulse to protect our own feelings and the feelings of others, what would happen if we created a culture of compassion and kindness in which we expect and accept imperfection and vulnerability? I'm thinking about Brené Brown's research on vulnerability. She says that people who have more meaningful lives, the people who are able to make the human connections that give life meaning, are the people who have the courage to be vulnerable. They are neither stoic, invulnerable, perfect people, nor are they puddles of insecurity tormented by their vulnerabilities. They accept their vulnerabilities as a matter of course. Life is hard. I'm not perfect. Other people aren't perfect. Let's just be open and help each other through it. If we accept these things, the imperfection of life, of self and others, then maybe we'll have less of an impulse to hide those imperfections. Maybe we'll be able to speak up honestly and say, I don't know that historical figure you just mentioned. Who is that? I'm sorry I'm late. I should have planned better. I'm doing my best to live up to my own ecological standards, but sometimes I fall short. Imagine if each of those statements was received with a guarantee of no judgment and instead was received with understanding and acceptance. And if we had a cultural baseline of acceptance, affirmation, and mutual encouragement, maybe our friend wouldn't be as hurt when we admitted with love that the sweater they gave us or the new haircut just isn't our style. They may be disappointed, but maybe they wouldn't take it personally. Their sense of their own value, their sense that we value them as a person, would remain intact. They would take it in stride. Oh, well, the gift didn't hit the mark. Sometimes that happens. If that's the way the whole culture was, wouldn't that allow us to be more honest? If we had a super strong culture of compassion, maybe we would let each other off the hook when we forgot each other's names, and we wouldn't have to fake it. Maybe we'd be more brave, and person A could tell person B the thing that's been upsetting them instead of claiming that it's fine and complaining to person C. We could affirm for one another that life is hard, things go wrong, we make mistakes, and that's okay. We are resilient creatures. As Brené Brown says, we are wired for struggle. We are imperfect, yes, but we are all, you are all, still worthy of love and belonging. If we knew this in our bones, if we supported one another in this kind of culture of compassion, perhaps we could relax into our flawed, authentic selves. We could be more honest and live as the people of integrity we desire to become. It was that kind of accepting compassion that my mother gave me that allowed me to confess my 6-year-old transgressions. That compassion, her compassion, nurtured me into honesty and integrity. I'm not sure exactly how this helps with our aunt with dementia, but there's something here. Whatever level of honesty works best for her, the thing that is more deeply true is that holding her through the heartache, walking together through life's difficulties, makes palpable that web of love and belonging that holds us all. And there's something in that that also helps us live as the people of integrity we desire to become. So here is my wish for all of us. May you be kind to yourselves. May we be kind to one another. May we cultivate a culture of compassion, which in turn nurtures a culture of honesty, empowering all of us to live with integrity. So may it be.